Good evening. Patrice was going to speak tonight, but she's not well, so we swapped places, so she'll be talking in late January. So I'm Nettie, if anyone doesn't know my name. There are many different gates to the Dharma. We can enter through contemplating impermanence, no self, emptiness, even a sort of a radical examination of cause and effect. But often I think for people, the Dharma gate of Buddha nature is just a really good one. You know, it's a really good gate. Because if we really can really penetrate that we are all Buddhas, all the other teachings fall into place. And it's a very compassionate entry point. We can say, have Buddha nature, or I am a Buddha, or this is my true nature. And the language makes it clumsy, you know, because we don't have it. We express it, we are it, it's not really an it. But with all of that aside, I think we understand what we're talking about, that we're untainted, you know, there's nothing wrong with us. At the most essential level, we're not a discrete being, there's nothing that could be tainted, you know. There's nothing that can actually have anything cling to it. And it's just our imagining that we are a discrete self that could be stained, that could be tainted, that could be evil. It's only because of our imagining of that that we feel so isolated. You know, it's a delusional thought that we could have a discrete being, mind and body, that could have something stuck to it that we feel bad about. It's only an appearance that it's like that. And I think it's actually quite useful just to coach ourselves to say, well, I'm feeling terrible, but I'm a Buddha. I think it's quite useful to just coach ourselves like that frequently, you know, over and over. We can say, I've made a mistake, I feel so embarrassed. Well, I'm a Buddha, I'm just an embarrassed Buddha. I think it's good to do that. I don't think it takes us the whole way, but I do think it's kind and it's a reminder and it helps us expand a little bit, even if it's a little bit theoretical. We can just still try. But really, I think we need to have a deep curiosity about ourselves, like a really deep curiosity about the parts of ourselves that we find difficult, you know. Because we can find some of ourselves, parts of ourselves difficult, some of our habits, or some of our past actions. But there's often sort of subtle ones that we don't like to look at. And I think that's the place to be curious, because that's often where the key is that can break our attachment to this idea of unworthiness. That can break that habit. A habitual pattern of feeling unworthy. I saw the documentary Blackfish yesterday. I don't know if anyone here has heard about it. Besides just being an incredibly tragic thing that we incarcerate animals and that this beautiful orca is kept in a tank at SeaWorld and is right there right now swimming around in the dark by himself. The documentary is about this animal and what's happened to him being incarcerated for so long. But I also just thought, I couldn't sleep last night, I was thinking about how what we have done to that animal is a little like what we do in our own minds to ourselves. You know, we are this beautiful big being. This orca should be swimming in this vast ocean, having a wonderful time with a big fin sticking up, cutting through the water. That's how we should be conducting ourselves. But actually what we often do to ourselves, at least part of the time, is we put ourselves into a concrete tank and we're just going round and round and our fins flopped over. So I'm going to read a case from the Blue Cliff Record, case number 7. Hui Chao asks about Buddha. A monk asked Fei An, "I am Hui Chao. What is Buddha?" Fei An said, "You are Hui Chao." So it's kind of, on a superficial level, it's pretty obvious that this case is saying something about you are Buddha, you know. But if we just think about it like that, it's not going to go very far for us. You know, it needs to be not just a reflex piece of dogma. When we hear it like this, we have to be able to imagine. Well, I think it would be a good idea for us to imagine. Could we hear those words and have them fully penetrate us, fully penetrate right through our being, go in and right through? So I'll read you a little bit of the commentary here. If you want to see the whole of what Fei An's device, you must be a fellow who doesn't turn his head when struck, a fellow with teeth like sword trees and a mouth like a blood bowl, who knows outside of words what they refer to. Then you will have a small portion of realization. If one by one they make intellectual interpretations, everyone on earth would be an exterminator of the Buddha's race. A little bit dramatic language there. As for Chan, the traveller who Charles awakening here, because he was awakened on hearing these words, on hearing his name, he was constantly engrossed in penetrating investigation. Therefore, under the impact of one word, it was as if the bottom fell out of his bucket. So what he was doing was constantly engrossed in penetrating investigation. And that's what we need to be doing in our practice, being constantly engrossed in a penetrating investigation of ourself and of everything that we're encountering. And that investigation is to investigate the pieces that we find uncomfortable, as well as the things that are beautiful. But the things we find uncomfortable, to really examine them and look at them and say, can I open my heart to them? Can I be curious about this little quality of myself that I don't feel so good about? Or the quality of my neighbour, or the quality of someone with a different political view than you? Anything, just a really genuine willingness to look into that. So there's a lovely example of someone doing just that in relation to Fei An, who's the teacher here. So I'll read you this story. It's like Superintendent C. He had been staying in Fei An's congregation, but had never asked to enter Fei An's room for special instruction. And this is, you know, like what we do here. Every now and then you meet with one of the teachers, with Patrick or Jean or Kokyo or one of the senior priests, you know, one of the priests here. You meet with them and check in with them. You know, how am I doing? How's my practice going? Well, this is happening. What are your thoughts on it? You know, you check in. We don't just practice in isolation. You know, we check in with a teacher and you know, get their feedback on us. It's very important that we do that. So this person, Superintendent C, hasn't been doing that. So he's been at the monastery, but he hasn't gone and checked in with the head teacher. One day, Fei Yin asked him, "Why haven't you come to enter my room?" C replied, "Didn't you know, teacher, when I was in Ching Li's place, I had an entry." So this might be something like he met with a teacher at a previous monastery. They had a Dharma exchange. He had a sense that he penetrated the Dharma and kind of got it. And so he didn't feel a need at this monastery to talk to this teacher because he'd had his conversation and he'd worked it out. Fei Yin said, "Try and recall it for me." C said, "I asked, what is Buddha?" And Lin said, "The fire god comes looking for fire." Dayan said, "Good words, but I'm afraid you misunderstood. Can you say something more for me?" C said, "The fire god is in the province of fire. He is seeking fire with fire. Likewise, I am Buddha, yet I went on searching for Buddha." And Fayan said, "Sure enough, the superintendent has misunderstood." Fayan is saying, "Well, I don't buy the words that you're saying here. I don't think you've got it." So, containing his anger, C left the monastery and went off across the river. Fayan said, "This man can be saved if he comes back. If he doesn't return, he can't be saved." Out on the road, C thought to himself, "He is the teacher of 500 people. How could he deceive me?" So just at that moment, he let his mind open. He let his mind go, maybe I'm being a bit arrogant. Or maybe I intellectually know things, but maybe I don't really know. You know, so this was beautiful. This moment, he came face to face with the habit of his mind. You know, some of us might have this habit. I don't think of this as my type of habit, but it could be. But certainly some people might resonate with this tendency. So he turned back and again called on Fei Yin, who told him, just ask me and I'll answer you." Thereupon C asked, "What is Buddha?" And Fei Yin said, "The fire god comes looking for fire." At these words, C was greatly enlightened. So there was something different between the first encounter and the second encounter. And in relation to this talk, I would say that the difference was that he became curious about an aspect of himself that he didn't really like and that he found uncomfortable. And he moved out of his habitual mind and welcomed an aspect of himself in, and that aspect said, go back and let yourself be taught. So he did. I think many of us reach a point in our practice where we've worked through a lot of the more gross or coarse or more sort of obvious aspects of unskillfulness, and we're left with the more subtle aspects of our thinking and our behavior that are not so easy, they're not so clear, you know. And how here's our opportunity to address them. Once we've worked through the first stages of practice, the first number of years, then it becomes the more subtle work, the places that are much more invisible to us, the places that are the dark, you know, the sort of blind spots where we need other people often to point them out to us. It's one of the reasons Sangha is so wonderful. I actually think that is really the only way for us to step off the top of that 100-foot pole. We don't step off into concepts of emptiness. We don't step off into concepts of impermanence. We step off into just being intimate with our actual life by forgiving someone who's harmed us, by forgiving ourselves for the errors that we made. For speaking just a little more truthfully. And we're basically very truthful, but we have these little tiny tendencies. So just getting a little better with those little tiny tendencies. It's letting go of old grudges. Letting go of particular opinions. It doesn't mean that our mind becomes just a mush or anything like that. We can still hold clear views, like I have clear views that we shouldn't be doing the things that we do to animals. It doesn't mean you have to become sloppy in your thinking, but you just be willing to just not have such definite views, particularly those views that you notice make you agitated. Anything that makes you agitated is probably an interesting place to examine. And maybe you may have had this experience also over the years when I've recited the precepts. And we did that last night in our full moon ceremony. I've noticed over the years different ones, as I recite them, I get this little contraction because I know I'm not doing such a good job with that particular one. Like maybe not speaking of the faults of others, or not taking what's not given. At different points in my life, different ones have been where I need to work, have been my edge, you know. So you might find that you have that experience too, and it's exactly that place where you have that contraction that's the gate to awakening. Like that is the gate. Because awakening is awakening to absolute inclusion of everything, like total inclusion of everything with no thing left out. That's what it's all about. So there's a little piece of your mind that you don't want to go to. That's your Dharma gate. That's your exact Dharma gate. And I was thinking about how wonderful that step is in the 12-step program, which I only know via other people. I don't know it directly, so I may not represent it very accurately, but people have told me about when they take the step where you go out and make amends and go out and apologize to all the people that you have harmed by your actions. And I've noticed when people take that on board and they do it without, it's not like a heavy beating themselves up for the harm that they've caused. It's just like, I'm really sorry that I made your life difficult for all that time. I'm really sorry, you know. It's just a very genuine apology. And I have noticed when people do that, their spirit is a lot lighter afterwards. You know, it's just a lot lighter. When we can start to hold more fully that we are Buddhas, then we don't mind having faults. Then we don't mind admitting our errors, because it's not so threatening. Because we're Buddhas. So we're Buddhas, we make mistakes. We make mistakes. It doesn't mean we're a deeply damaged, broken human being because we make mistakes. So it gives us courage. The more we contemplate that we're Buddhas, the more courage we have to admit our mistakes. I'd like to read just a little bit from the beginning of a case 13 in the Mamongkhan Taishan's Bowls in Hand. So Taishan was a great teacher, head of a monastery, and here one day Taishan descended to the dining hall, bowls in hand. Sui Feng asked him, "Where are you going with your bowls in your hand, old teacher? The bell has not rung and the drum has not sounded." Taishan turned and went back to his room. I remember when I heard this thinking, wow, he was the head teacher. He just got reprimanded by the head monk for coming down to the dining hall too early. And he just turned around and walked back to his room. It didn't upset his mind that he got corrected. And Robert Aitken makes some comments about that. So first, I won't go through this part, but he describes how the monks, when they carry the bowl, it's the tradition of going out for alms. So you take the bowl out traditionally to the public and people will put food in your bowl and you may or may not receive very much food, you know. And it's a real act of... I can't think of a word, but it's very open-hearted. You're just going out and saying, here's my bowl. If you have some food, you could put it in. So it's very open. It's very gentle. And so that was the kind of mood that Taishan was in as he just walked down the stairs with his bowls ready to go to the dining hall. And then he got told, oh, what are you doing here at this time? It's too early. So in this, this is Robert Aitken commenting here. It is with this naive spirit of trust then that Taishan came down to the dining hall. Some versions of this story say that the meal was late. Sui Feng challenged him saying, what are you doing with your bowls in hand, old teacher? The bell has not rung, the drum has not sounded. Taishan turned and went back to his room. One might expect him to say, as head of the temple, the meal is late. You know our schedule is tight. When we have to wait for the meal, this means the time for the monks to rest is shortened and they need their rest. So it's important that we have our meal on time. But he did not say such a thing. He just turned and went back to his room. Because Taishan was not spending time in his mind trying to defend himself against his own negative thoughts about himself. He was not exhausted from trying to justify his own actions to himself. He didn't have any defensiveness about him because he was, I imagine, fairly much at ease in this very big space that he inhabited in his mind. He was the monastery, he was the hills around the monastery and the plants and animals in the monastery. So if someone says, you've come down too early, okay, and turn around, you know. Whereas I think for a lot of us, a lot of people at different times in our life, we are actually thinking, I'm not that bad, I'm not, and we're having a lot of conversation with ourselves about ourselves, forgetting our Buddha nature. So then when someone comes in and makes a little criticism, it's like, oh, I've just spent all day defending myself to myself, and now you're criticizing me, and I now need to defend myself to you, you know, which is why it's so exhausting. I actually noticed a little change in myself in relation to this. I live in a big share house with lots of people, and as you can imagine, people have got different ideas about how things are done, and different people at different times will think someone did something, whether they did that thing or not. So little mild misunderstandings happen a lot. And I did used to find when someone would say something to me like, was that you that didn't clean the blender properly, or something like that, I'd find myself like, oh, there's more important things in life. I've got other things that I'm defending in my head already. I don't want to have to defend myself about this blender. So I just would get contract, you know. And I've noticed lately that I've been being a little bit more like Taishan. It's been very nice. Like when someone says, don't put that thing there. I'm like, oh, okay. It's not bothering me so much if someone says, don't like you putting the thing there. Okay. Okay. very liberating to practice being Buddhas and knowing that we are Buddhas. When we are secretly disliking ourselves, we're falling into the delusion that we are separate from others. We're comparing ourselves to others as if others exist separately from us. And often we're actually imagining what others will be thinking of us, and that is delusional as well, because all those other people are just extensions of us. And so to set up a dialogue like that in our own minds is very unhealthy. So often we contract with self-doubt and feelings of shame about such things as, just here's just a quick list, sure we could add many more, but it starts to become kind of tedious. But the common things are things like, I'm stupid, I'm a phony, I'm ugly, I'm not smart enough, I'm too shy, I'm too clumsy, I'm too old, I'm too brash, I'm too lame, I'm too mediocre, that kind of thing. So how might we kind of break this subtle cycle, even if for many of us it may be a much more subtle cycle now, you know, after years of practice usually these voices do really quieten down. But if we want to awaken in this lifetime, and I think there's absolutely no reason why all of us can't do that in this lifetime, then we need to pay attention to these subtle thoughts of unworthiness. Either, I think more people tend to feel unworthy about themselves, but sometimes people have a tendency more to think of others as unworthy. So whichever direction your tendency is more, it's through that subtle examination of those subtle patterns of thinking unworthy thoughts about ourselves and others that we do need to shed if we are going to awaken in this lifetime. Because awakening can't have exclusions. So if there's anything that we're feeling is unworthy or is wrong in some essential way, like obviously there's nothing, not a problem with thinking that a particular behaviour is not a good idea, but to think that anything is essentially wrong, that will definitely get in the way. It will make it impossible. It's like this little tiny grain of sand will completely block your path, block our path. So if we practice reminding ourselves that we are Buddha and seeing if we can start trying to believe it a little more, and practice good behavior. And partly, you know, the form that we have at the Zendo is very much to support that for us. It's there to support good behavior in us, wholesome thinking, wholesome action, quietening down of the mind. This is what our community offers for us, a way to help us to slow down and to be skillful. As we're more skillful, we believe that we're Buddhas more. And as we believe that we're Buddhas more, we become more skillful. So it becomes this beautiful dance between our actions and our thoughts, our actions and our thoughts. And we have our precepts to guide us. So we look at the precepts and apply them to ourselves, in our particular way. Like whatever's important for you in the precepts, your version of the precepts. Poem I'd like to read. So the more that we do that, actually, then it starts to become kind of more natural and more fluid and more relaxed. And the effort becomes a little less. And the process is just more gently curious. So here's a poem by Rumi that kind of gets a feeling of that. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. So that is from a book by Tara Brach called Radical Acceptance, which if you think this idea of, she uses the term the trance of unworthiness, which I think is a wonderful term, that we can get caught in unworthiness. We kind of get caught in a vortex of it. And she talks about that. Really lovely, wonderful book, wonderful book. So I want to leave some time for conversations. I just want to end with the question and a little answer. So could it be that just this one little thing about yourself that you don't like, could it be that that one little thing could be the difference between you awakening or not awakening? Yes, it could. Go there. Just go there. Just like the superintendent C, his arrogance was his barrier. When he let it go, he was fire. He was the fire god. Just like Hu Qiao, who his constant, engrossed, penetrating investigation allowed him to hear his name, and he woke up. Okay, thank you. Should have a little bit of time for some conversation. Would anyone like to comment or ask a question? Patrick? Constantly engrossed, penetrating investigation. That you model that curiosity to our Sangha every day, and I'm very grateful for that. Someone could share one of their neuroses if they liked. That would generate conversation.
It's not a question, but it brings to mind something. I did a session. came with Charlotte Turtle Beck. And it was toward the end, I saw a couple of times at the end for Dr. Sun. I sort of asked her, what's the most important thing that you've learned? And she said, it's simply a question. How do I know this? Whatever she thinks she knows. So it's curiosity about things we do think we know. Or anything that's really fixed in our mind. How do I know this? You know, is there more to it than what I'm receiving? And usually that's the case. Yeah. And just then being happy to be in that sea of unknowing, because you can never know exactly in any situation the whole truth, all of it. You can only know a small part of it and be able to rest easy in that not knowing. For sure.
Yes.
Anyway.
Thank you, Stan.
As far as I know,
Michael?
As far as I know, there's only one knower. And once the knower knows himself, there probably isn't anything else worth knowing.
Thank you. Chris.
I was curious about something that you had mentioned. You said one of the monks, he wasn't spending that much time in his mind. I was curious about that concept of not spending that much time in the mind. Maybe it means just like turning the wheels too much, or maybe someplace else. I wonder where that was.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on, what are your thoughts on what that might mean?
Well, under the circumstances of the story, I thought it wasn't, he just wasn't immersing himself in it, in the idea of him being right or wrong. Or, it's just kind of a little step back a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, because like in that moment when someone maybe corrects us, commonly what we do is suddenly we solidify us, them, and a series of thoughts start to cascade, and that's kind of the busy thing in the mind. If we don't do that and just see that I'm a Buddha, they're a Buddha, which is kind of clumsy, but you know, just to have our language, we say it that way. And there isn't this sudden sense of two separate beings, but rather we're just one dance together. Then the person has just said, it's not time for the meal. And then all you have to do is go, oh, okay. You know, that's all it is. It's you as a separate person. It doesn't suddenly come in. So that's how I was think of it when I said, you know, there wasn't a lot of thinking in his mind, you know, the sense of him as a separate being with being right or wrong or judged by this other separate being, that he didn't do that. I mean, the dance could have gone just as, like, as long as if there's one way of doing it, he might have said, yes, but we do need to go to the hall now. I mean, he might have needed to say that, and then he would have said that, but he would have said it because they needed to go to the hall now. Not because I'm the boss and you're trying to something, something, so I'm going to something, something. It would have just been, no, no, we actually do need to. And that's all. Yeah. Michael?
Scientific evidence on the brain waves in the from the cerebral cortex and the brain, and it shows that up to the age of 6, children are more or less in a kind of a hypnotic state where they don't have any ability to objectify things. So when they're in a family environment, they absorb whatever negativity is going on. And if somebody says, you're clumsy, enough times, the circuit will be imprinted in the brain. And so now you have a circuit going on there that self-solicits itself under a lot of different circumstances.
Yes.
And as far as I know, the only real way to decondition those circuits is through constant meditation. Now, there might be some therapeutic areas that might achieve something like that, but as far as I know, the best way is through constant meditation that clears out those negative imprints, those negative circuits. It actually breaks the circuits. So
yeah.
There's a scientific basis behind some of that stuff you were talking about.
Thank you for mentioning that. Because by saying to ourselves, I am Buddha, we're being the good parent. Because to a little child, to a mother to a little child, or a father to a little child, their child is the perfect Buddha. My child's the best, look at my child. You know, parents, a good parent absolutely adores their child. They adore their child completely, unconditionally. Completely. So that's what we're supposed to be thinking about ourselves, you know. But we do have parents that make mistakes, and therefore we do get these negative thoughts in our minds. So this practice, psychologically, you could say we are re-parenting ourselves. That doesn't sound so... kind of sounds a bit, I don't know, mundane or something. Not so lofty, yeah. It feels more like, corridors with linoleum flooring or something. We're reparenting ourselves. No, I think I prefer this kind of like, we're Buddhas. But both. Hannah.
How do you explain, I am Buddha, you are Buddha, the dance begins to talk about it. But how do you explain it? How do you define it?
That's what we can't do. That's the bit that we... I think we express it in our bodies. You know, when we watch the priest bowing, sometimes my heart just cracks open as I'm watching the priest bowing, you know. So they're expressing their Buddha nature when they do that. I think words really can't take us there. You know, so a talk like this really is just it's just a pointing kind of a thing. It's really it's just an encouragement. A talk like this is just encouragement. The actual understanding can't come through this. Mm-hmm. And Kokyo sometimes says this is just the sort of light entertainment, so we don't have to sit so much. Okay. Last comments anyone would like to make before we close for tea? Thank you so much for co-creating this. I would like to dedicate any merit that comes from this Dharma exchange to all suffering beings, human and all other animal forms. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Divisions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dhamma.